Good afternoon, everybody. If everyone can take their seats when they get a moment. My name is Patrick Ross, and I would like to welcome you on behalf of all of my colleagues at the Progress and Freedom Foundation and IP Central to our latest congressional seminar titled The Role of Music Licensing in a Digital Age. Now, that's a pretty broad topic. One interesting avenue to explore might be to what extent we should even have licenses, in particular compulsory licenses. Do they prevent reasonable market transactions? Do the reduced transaction costs offset the dilution of intellectual property rights for artists? As interesting as that discussion might be, the reality is that licensing has been a part of the music industry for a century, and these licenses aren't going anywhere. Given this reality, a more pertinent set of questions might be, are current licensing regimes balanced across content, services, and technologies? How are the licensing regimes responding to new disruptive technologies? What can Congress do to ensure balance in licensing and create an environment that invites new technologies while also appropriately rewarding artists? That's where I anticipate our discussion will go today. Currently, there's legislation in both the House and the Senate that addresses some of these questions. It's known as the PERFORM Act. Now, don't ask me what PERFORM stands for. It's another one of these artful yet tortured acronyms that's spreading across Capitol Hill like kudzu. I personally have proposed legislation that would ban such cute nicknames. I call the legislation the End of Needless, Over-the-Top, Unnecessarily Gratuitous Handles Act, or in short, the Enough Act. Now, no one has introduced the Enough Act, but the PERFORM Act has been introduced in the Senate by Dianne Feinstein and Lindsey Graham, along with Joe Biden and Majority Leader Bill Frist, and in the House by Howard Berman and Mary Bono. What would the PERFORM Act do? Well, that seems to vary depending on who you talk with, and rather than rely on my interpretation, I'd prefer we hear it from our expert panelists. I'll attempt a brief and overly generalistic summary. The PERFORM Act aims to harmonize rates set for various digital music licenses under one standard based on a fair market value, requires users of a digital government license to provide reasonably available and economically feasible technology to prevent music theft, and it attempts to distinguish between a performance license and a distribution license, stating that a recording device that has TiVo-like characteristics, such as recording by time or program, does not require a distribution license, but being able to, say, record every one of Led Zeppelin's tunes would. That last point has gotten most of the press attention with this bill, and the Senate hearing actually turned into a debate over whether XM Satellite Radio needed a distribution license for its new receiver, such as the Pioneer Inno, that permits recording by artist or song programmed in advance. We have a representative from the Recording Industry Association of America with us today. We were going to have an XM Satellite Radio representative as well, but they decided not to participate after the RIA sued them. So thank you, Mitch. I suspect, however, that we'll hear a point of view very similar to XM's from our Consumer Electronics Association representative today. Now, we've put bios on all four of our panelists on the table, so I won't belabor their backgrounds, but let me briefly introduce them. Our first panelist is Mitch Glazier, Executive Vice President for Government and Industry Relations with the RIA. Before joining the RIA, Mitch was dealing with these very issues as Chief Counsel on the House Judiciary IP Subcommittee. Our second panelist is Michael Petricone, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Consumer Electronics Association. He frequently speaks and testifies on these issues before Congress. And if I am very nice to him today, it's because I'm hoping that he'll give me a VIP pass to the next Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Also joining us today is Lee Knife, General Counsel for the Digital Media Association, which represents webcasters. And I think Lee is perfect for this panel, as he spent 15 years dealing with these issues in the recording industry with labels such as EMI, BMG, The Sanctuary Group, and PolyGram. Another expert on the arcane world of music licensing is Christian Castle, our final panelist, an LA-based entertainment lawyer. And Chris, thanks for flying out for this. Chris's clients include a number of labels, artists, and technology companies. Now, his background in law is more than sufficient to qualify him for this panel, but as some of you know, I have a bias for artists in this debate, and before his legal career, Chris was a working musician, performing with artists such as Jesse Winchester, Yvonne Elliman, and Long John Baldry. I've asked each of our panelists to give brief opening remarks, letting us know their thoughts on music licensing and the Perform Act. And after that, I will give the panelists a chance to respond to each other. I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll open it up for audience questions. And Mitch, if we could begin with you and then just go down the row.
Thanks for coming today. It's a terrific turnout, which says that it's recess and the lunch is pretty good. And I hope that you're also interested in some of the topic that we're going to be talking about today. It is incredibly complicated, unfortunately polarizing, and we think very necessary. We basically have the typical situation where technology leaps ahead, and laws that were created around particular technologies can't leap ahead to the extent that the technology does. And so you have certain technologies being covered by legislative licensing provisions that were negotiated or adopted or implemented at the time that the technology was created. And they were written specifically for what people knew about that technology at the time it was done. I mean, there's a pretty easy explanation as to why the copyright licenses for satellite technology are different from internet technology, are different from cable technology. And that's because they were done at different times based on what we knew about those technologies. And so you have a bizarre situation where in 1998, for example, when the internet provisions of the copyright licenses were written, the internet was viewed as a giant copying machine. And so there were provisions put in the law to make sure that internet radio companies couldn't, in technical terms, cause or induce the making of a phono record. What does that mean? It means you can't, you're a radio service, you can't allow consumers to keep something that will substitute for a sale. There's a difference between radio and selling music, and the idea was to make sure that there was a line there. And so a webcaster under current law cannot cause or induce the making of a phono record. But that same provision doesn't apply to satellite radio companies or the radio channels that you get on DirecTV or on Comcast, because those were written 3 years earlier. And satellite companies don't have weren't viewed at the time as being giant copying machines. So the 98 amendments that applied this certain requirement to internet technology grandfathered in satellite and cable technology, and you now have a disparity. So you have digital radio services offered across several different platforms now. You have it across the cable-like platforms, across satellite radio, across internet radio or webcasting, and now across over-the-air high-definition radio. All of them are digital radio services. All of them are now converging to the point where through technology or devices, they can offer similar types of products to similar consumers, and they can start competing head-to-head. If you want to see evidence of them competing head-to-head, just look at advertisements in the marketplace. Look at what they're saying with the rollout of HD radio. Look at what XM is saying about Sirius and what Sirius is saying about XM. Come attend one of the debates where the parties are talking about their offerings and what they're bringing to the consumer. This is good for music. The devices are good for music. The exposure is good for music. All the new platforms are good for music. And I think that our company's perspectives are that all of this is terrific and will help consumers even more in the digital age, but there has to be fair competition among platforms and providers, and there has to be an adequate system for licensing and compensation. The way that the licenses work is, as I said, there's a wall. The compulsory license, the government license, applies to performances. It applies to broadcasts. It applies when you are streaming your digital radio and a consumer is listening but not keeping a copy. There is a difference between that and selling music, when the consumer keeps a copy to enjoy that they can listen to when they want. And if you want evidence of that, look at the different models that are licensed in the marketplace right now. Take a company like Rhapsody, which is owned by Real Networks. They have three different types of licenses that they operate under right now. One of them is the government compulsory license for their radio service. And then two are done in the private sector, which is where most licensing should be done. One of them is for a subscription service. It's an all-you-can-eat model where a consumer pays $12 to $14.95 a month. They rent their music. They get all that they can handle. And the music is tethered to the subscription. It's like HBO. You stop paying your $9.95, $12.95, $14.95 a month, your music goes away. There's a second license that they have, a distribution license like iTunes has or other download services have. And that's where a consumer owns the music. They pay 99 cents, 79 to 99 cents for the track, and they keep it. So you have two types of marketplace licenses where a consumer can keep a copy, and you have a government compulsory license where there's a performance only and the consumer listens to it. Now, that's what happens when somebody's licensing and doing what they're supposed to do under the rules. The question is, when there's convergence, when a satellite radio station can do the same types of things that Rhapsody is doing, should they have to get the same types of licenses that Rhapsody has to get? We think that they should. We think that if you're talking about fair use, or you're talking about TiVo-like capabilities where you're recording by time, program, or channel, you don't need a license for that. But if you're talking about substituting a sale and offering a consumer something that they can keep, where they otherwise would have paid for it, to the benefit of the music provider. In other words, we're going to use this functionality to lure subscribers so we get more people to pay $14.95 a month to the provider. Then you have to go out into the marketplace and license the music creator. And so what the Perform Act is about is harmonizing the law so that if you are enabling the making of a phonorecord, in other words, if you're offering something to the consumer to keep that would approach a sale or substitute for a sale, then you have to go out into the private marketplace and get a license to do that. If you're just offering TiVo, or if you're a performance service, you don't. And it would apply across the board to everybody, satellite, cable, and internet. It doesn't apply to over-the-air radio because they are exempt from that. And so you may have heard about the audio broadcast flag debate. The audio flag legislation, which is in the Commerce Committees right now, imposes the same sort of structure on over-the-air, but does so through FCC and Spectrum instead of through the copyright licenses. So we are trying to assure a technology-neutral manner of adopting in the marketplace licenses that work in the digital age so consumers can get all the functionality they want. It's just that creators are compensated for them instead of sales being substituted so that the digital age produces less music rather than more. Oh, and it's that simple.
Mitch, you sure convinced me. I'll pass. I'm glad Mitch thinks these are terrific devices. I wish he'd tell his attorneys to stop suing them. We'd all be much better off. Before I begin talking about the statistics, I just want to start with a quote. And the quote is this: I foresee a marked deterioration in American music and musical taste, an interruption of the musical development of this country, and a host of other injuries to music and its artistic manifestations by the virtue, or rather the vice, of the multiplication of these various music reproducing machines. This was Mitch last week talking about, and I'm just kidding. This was John Philip Sousa in 1904, over 100 years ago, when he came to you, to Congress, asking that you stop the production of these player pianos because they were going to be the death of the music industry. And if you look back historically, that was the same reaction that the music industry and their Hollywood had to music on the radio, television, the VCR. Remember, the Betamax was to the American movie industry as the Boston Strangler is to the woman at home, according to Jack Valenti, TiVo, the MP3 player, and so forth. And I guess I'm giving you context because context is important. The fact is that for over 100 years, virtually every new consumer music technology has left the music industry running to you or running to Congress saying that this is going to be the ruination of the industry and demanding that you do something about it. Usually, you've had the wisdom to say no. And now, you know, this is kind of a Groundhog Day argument. We're back. And now the target is this device. Now, maybe they're right. Maybe the sky really is falling this time. But again, given the context, given the history here, I think you've got the right to be skeptical. Now, let's talk about the product. Now, as Mitch said, the law distinguishes recording radio transmissions for personal use from distribution by downloading, like iTunes or Rhapsody. This is not like iTunes. This is like recording off the radio. You can't choose what you get to hear. The DJ plays it or not. You can't move the songs off the device or burn them to a CD or move them to your computer. And they disappear. They go poof if you stop your subscription. What these products do is allow you to time shift the programming that you've lawfully accessed through your subscription. Now, these products allow exactly the kind of recording covered by the Audio Home Recording Act. And the royalties paid on every one of these devices sold under the AHRA go to songwriters, performers, music publishers, and record labels. So Mitch says we've got to make sure the creative people are being compensated. They are being compensated. Now, the Audio Home Recording Act was fully intended to cover digital audio recording technologies that record from broadcast transmissions. That was understood under the law. As a matter of fact, if you look at the Audio Home Recording Act, under the very important section, Entitlement to Royalty Payments, which RIA helped write, royalty payments are due when a musical work or sound recording has been distributed in the form of a digital music recording or analog music recording or disseminated to the public in transmissions. And this is a transmission. And that's why during the debate on the Audio Home Recording Act, Jay Berman, who is the head of the RIA, said that this bill will eliminate the legal uncertainty about home taping that has clouded the marketplace. This bill will bar copyright infringement lawsuits on both analog and digital audio home recording by consumers and for the sale of audio home recording equipment by manufacturers and importers. It will thus allow consumer electronics manufacturers to introduce new audio technology into the market without fear of infringement lawsuits. If only that were so. So, you know, again, these products are perfectly legal and covered and anticipated by the Audio Home Recording Act. Of course, in addition to the Audio Home Recording Act royalties, XM and Sirius also pay the recording industry tens of millions of dollars a year in performance royalties. This is more than all other payers combined. Of course, you know, broadcast over-the-air radio pays zero. Now, let's talk about what these devices don't do. They don't enable audio recording. You cannot say, go out and find every Led Zeppelin song out there and record it. It will not do that. There seems to be a difference of question or fact in there. That sounds like an interesting product, but that product is not for sale, and that is not something that these products don't do. They don't allow digital copying or uploading to the internet, so this is not about piracy. This is not about the internet. This is not about P2P. This is about what consumers can do for non-commercial purposes with their lawfully accessed content in their private homes and vehicles. I guess... I'd just like to sum up by saying that satellite radio is one of America's top 21st century technology success stories. And most importantly, they're doing it right. They're providing over 10 million Americans with lawful, new, exciting services. They're following the laws that Congress designed to apply to digital music recorders. They pay compensation to songwriters and music publishers through the Audio Home Recording Act. And they pay tens of millions of dollars in royalties to the music industry. So, at CEA, we are fully committed to ensuring that artists and copyright holders are compensated under the law. We are also committed to standing up for the rights of innovators to bring new products to market and the rights of consumers to exercise their normal and customary fair use rights like recording off the radio. Thank you.
We at DEMA have a middle of the road approach from what you've heard so far. With regard to the Perform Act itself, we largely support the act and the measures that it's trying to make. Most importantly, some of the things that Mitch talked about with regard to trying to arrive at a parity and an even playing field with regard to the royalties that would be paid across different technologies, devices, and media. That's one of the biggest problems that we face from the DEMA perspective, and it's certainly one that we think the Perform Act is doing a good job of trying to trying to address. We also happen to agree, however, with the idea that the Perform Act is trying to protect copyright owners and artists from services that might otherwise substitute for legitimate sales of music, and might act as substitutional for other types of sales of music. We wish that the Act would go a little bit further than it does in addressing some other issues that pertain to the areas that we're talking about here, in terms of compulsory licensing and the rights to exploit music. We'd like to see the Act address the idea of interactivity and try to clarify some of the issues around the various technologies in the media, and more clearly define what is interactive and statutorily enabled radio, internet radio, versus what is truly interactive and could be deemed substitutional for the sales of records. We'd also like to see it resolve some of the issues regarding what are ephemeral recordings, or the equivalent of ephemeral recordings with respect to digital services. Historically, ephemeral recordings have been exempted, and terrestrial broadcast radio has been allowed to retain ephemeral recordings for the purposes of advancing their businesses. And the technology behind digital radio causes digital radio services and the internet-based businesses to have several different copies and several different server copies and various copies that go through the stream of delivering digital audio. We'd like to see the Act go further and more clearly address the issues surrounding the use, the value of, and the licensing and royalty, if any, that would be applicable to those types of uses. That's really it for now, other than discussing it.
Great, thank you. Chris?
I think it might be helpful to put this this sound recording performance right in a little bit of context internationally for everyone. The United States is really the only country, I'll say in the world, and I'm probably wrong, but I'm probably about 98% right, that doesn't pay a royalty, doesn't recognize the right of a sound recording owner and the artist whose performances are embodied in that sound recording to receive a royalty of some kind when that track is played in any broadcast or other performance setting. There's an organization in the UK called Phonographic Performance Limited that collects a lot of this money. And in 2004, those collections were about £80 million, and it grows at a rate of about 3 or 4% a year, it would seem. So you can do the math on that. So this is not a trivial amount of money that's collected internationally and paid out to record companies and both featured and non-featured artists. We don't have that here for terrestrial radio. So when people talk about taping off the air, it's not as if that implicates any right on the sound recording side on terrestrial radio, because artists don't get paid when records are played on terrestrial radio. Record companies don't get paid when records are played on terrestrial radio. And in fact, the only place that artists and record companies do get paid on any kind of radio is if it's performed on the internet or digitally, satellite, cable, and so on. And granted, they do pay some money for that, but it's important, I think, to understand that the rest of the world has no question in their mind that artists and record companies should get paid any time a sound recording is performed in any public performance setting. So that's, I think, an important thing to keep in mind when you start comparing things to TiVos and recording, home taping off the radio, and mixtapes of things that you put together off the radio, like when you were a kid, you know, and all these sort of analogies that people make that are really not that accurate. So from an artist perspective and an artist representative perspective, it's important what happens here, because ultimately the real fight is going to be on terrestrial broadcast radio And I think that fight is coming as we see digital radio start to come online. And the difference between digital radio from a stick and digital radio from a satellite becomes less and less easy to distinguish. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that it's I don't mean to be insulting to anyone, but it's in, I am always struck by how technology companies view music licensing. At one point when I was younger and more cavalier, I used to liken it to that beginning section of 2001 where the monolith kind of appears and they're all sort of mystified by it. Because it's not something that any technology company really ever comes in contact with. I mean, to say to someone at a tech company, well, your programmer should own the code or should get a reversion in the code that they create or should get a royalty for the code that they create, it just doesn't compute. You know, they just don't know how to react to it. They give them some stock, and if the programmer's lucky enough to save the company over the year that his stock, you know, his initial cliff vests and, you know, and so on, all the different stock option issues, yeah, then maybe if good things happen and the company eventually goes public and so on and so on and so on, way, 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 way down the line, the programmer may actually get some money for it. Unlike an artist and a record company, these much maligned record companies that spend a lot of money to promote artists and artists who go out and tour and put their own blood, sweat, and tears into developing their product. These people expect to get paid whenever anybody makes money off of their music. And I think that is sort of a fundamental fairness question that has to be looked at whenever you're looking at devices, services, any use where anytime anybody makes money off of my music or my client's music, I think we have a reasonable expectation of getting paid. Not to mention the songwriter, who is often the person who's completely overlooked in this entire process, because the person who just writes songs is not an artist, doesn't tour, just sits and writes songs and tries to get covers on those songs, meaning that tries to get an artist to record their song and put it out there, which you see a lot of in places like Nashville and less of in places like New York and L.A. anymore. Those people are getting hurt, I think, the most by file sharing, you know, all the leakage in this system. And you rarely ever see people staying up late nights worrying about the songwriter. So I think that when you look at what's going on with these devices, songwriters arguably should probably get a mechanical royalty for the download off of the service. Record companies should be able to collect a royalty for the sound recording piece, and then there will be a fight, of course, on the record company side between the artist and the record company as to who gets what piece of that and so on and so on. But some of these things have been decided. And it seems very obvious to me that these devices are distributions of permanent copies. And back to my point about the tech company, it's entirely possible that people went into this with the best of intentions, thinking that they were within the law. I've had companies come to me having spent extraordinary amounts of money. One I can think of off the top of my head where they spent $70 million developing a product which was going to have obvious music licensing problems. Had they talked to anybody at the beginning, they probably wouldn't have done the product. And when they came to me, they were saying, is this really true? I mean, could this possibly be true that we have to go ask this person, this person, this person, and this person? Because when we hire a programmer, we don't have to talk to them ever again, you know? So you have a situation here which I think is going to get resolved in court, unfortunately, because XM evidently, you know, didn't, I'm not part of that, but XM apparently didn't settle. And when I see that case, I think of the MP3.com case, and I had guys from MP3.com call me, you know, weeks before Michael Robertson bet the company on mymp3.com, which he eventually had to deed over to Universal, you know, and actually, you know, believed that they were in the right, thought everything was fine, and as soon as the thing went out, they were dead meat. And I told them they were dead meat, And they ignored me. Not, that's why they were dead meat, but but they went out and did it anyway, and I sat there and I watched them. I watched them throw the company down the drain. So it wouldn't be the first time that a tech company came to these situations with the best of intentions, wanting to have a product that satisfied consumers, that was innovative, that was interesting, but just didn't have the right rights. And as my one of my old bosses used to say, I find the rights are a good place to start. So on that note, right. I will leave it to you.
All right. Thank you, Chris. I'd like to give our panelists a chance to respond to some of the comments, and I think Michael had some words to say.
I guess, first of all, it's interesting to be lectured on our cavalier attitude toward licenses by a guy who's representing a company that was founded by the guy who founded Napster. But I guess that's a definition. I think the reason that XM and Sirius went forward on this thinking they were within the law is because, in fact, they were within the law. These are not distributions. These are transmissions. Once again, it's not like iTunes where you sit down and type in Red Hot Chili Peppers and download the new Red Hot Chili Peppers record, which you can then move to your iPod or your computer or what have you. It's like the radio. You get a song if the DJ plays it, which may be tomorrow, which may be never. It's like the radio in that the DJ may be talking over the first part of the track, the end blends into the next track, and so forth. But it's clearly not a distribution. Again, this is exactly the kind of recording that was contemplated under the Audio Home Recording Act. I think one of the most interesting parts of the lawsuit that the RIA mentioned, or the RIA filed, is the Audio Home Recording Act is never mentioned anywhere in the lawsuit. And, if only it were that easy to white out parts of the statute book. But it's not. It's the law. And it applies. And I guess, finally, the point I'd like to make is, first of all, in the Perform Act, it is not just a matter of preventing it from recording all the Led Zeppelin songs. The Act, actually, the technology mandates in the Act are much more stringent. It would prevent you from recording, say, three songs and then listening to them in the order that you want. For example, if this were applied to the video world, let's say you're going out tonight and you want to set your TiVo to record the Miami Heat game, the Heat Pistons game tonight on ESPN. Well, if this applied to the video world, then what you'd have to do is record ESPN from 6 o'clock to 11 o'clock, and when you wanted to watch it, you can't go to that program and you can't fast forward. You got to watch the whole thing. Finally, I guess the last point is people keep on talking about how this is going to bring equity and this is about platform equity. And in fact, the title of the bill is the Platform Equity Reform Act and so forth. This has nothing to do with equity. This doesn't impact analog over-the-air broadcast radio, which pays no royalties. This doesn't impact digital over-the-air broadcast radio, which pays no royalties. This doesn't in any way impact recording a digital stream over the consumer. This specifically singles out one technology, this technology, for punitive new fees and tech mandates. So it's not, this has nothing to do with equity at all. It's a matter of singling out one new service that, in fact, is legal under the law.
Mitch?
Oh, my. If you can't get all equity, you ought not get any, I guess, is the theme of what you're saying. I think if you can get some, you ought to get it, and let's keep moving forward and eventually get it all, is what I would sort of think. I also think that the draftors of the Perform Act did a very good job of being practical and reasonable, because what you're saying is, of course, just not true. It says that you can record by time, program, or channel. So if you want to record a program, you can record it by the program. So if you want to record the Heat game, then record the Heat game and watch it later and time shift. That's okay. What you can't do is the equivalent of saying, I want to record Saturday Night Live, but I only want to record the band performance of Saturday Night Live. I want to cherry pick just that performance out, but I don't want to tape the rest of the show. You can't do that. You record the show. If you fast forward because you want to see the band, you fast forward because you want to see the band. Consumers don't seem to mind that inconvenience of fast-forwarding when they're automatically recording in that fashion, especially if it means that there's going to be more content produced in more ways with more functionality for them later on. They also don't seem to mind buying music. It only seems to be multi-billion dollar corporations that mind paying for music. Consumers say that they're very happy to pay a couple bucks more a month to be able to keep music, or 99 cents to be able to keep a track. So this is not a consumer problem. This is a problem of companies trying to figure out where they can cut corners. They don't mind paying $3 billion to roll out their system. They don't mind paying billions of dollars for satellites. They don't mind paying for all of their technology. And by the way, they pay market rates. There's no compulsory license that lets them get their CE products at a cheaper subsidized cost. And they have no problem paying all the patent fees for all the consumer electronic devices that they use in all of their products. The only thing that they want to cut is what they pay for music. It'd be like a restaurant saying, okay, I'll pay for the rent, and I'll pay for the air conditioning, and I'll pay for the silverware, but I'm just not going to pay for that food because, you know, that's just unfair. So from our point of view, this is a step towards equity, and it's really, really important. The other thing is that if you're saying that this doesn't enable a recording, and you're saying that it only allows time shifting and consumers to tape off the radio like they always have, then you have nothing to worry about because the Perform Act only prohibits the enabling of a recording. So if it's not enabling, don't worry. It only says that other than time shifting and manual recording, it's the automatic cherry picking, substituting for a sale. That's what's prohibited. If it's not doing that, then you have nothing to worry about. So the good news is that the tradition of consumers doing what they do on the radio without paying is preserved. But new companies taking advantage of technological innovations to lure subscribers for their own profit but not pay for the substitution of a sale to the creators who are providing the product that they're making their money off of is just ludicrous. You have 120 channels. 69 are dedicated to music. Every poll shows that the number one reason why consumers go to these services is because of music. So let's pay in the marketplace for the music. If you can pay Major League Baseball $150 million, if you can pay Howard Stern $600 million, if you can pay Oprah $50 million, then why can't you pay in the marketplace for the music that's actually attracting the people that who are paying the subscriber fees, that's giving you the money to allow you to operate in the first place? That is the equity that we're talking about.
Mitch, we're paying. I'll pull out my wallet and pay you more. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, we're not Napster here. I'm sorry, the old Napster. We're paying tens of millions of dollars in performance fees. We're, you know, paying royalties on every one of these devices onto the audio home recording.
That's like saying, I paid for the concert, I don't want to pay for this.
We're opening up broad new revenue streams for the record industry. So if you want to tell me, you know something, we're getting a lot of money here, but you know something, we want more, then I'm okay with it. But don't say we're not paying. You're getting compensated very well.
Can I just ask a question? Yes, go ahead, Chris, and then we're going to go into questions.
Okay, so Mitch, I actually, to Michael's point about why the lawsuit, and I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but why the lawsuit doesn't mention the Audio Home Recording Act. The reason, I mean, I don't know what the strategy was, but in reading it, it seems to me that the offending part of the chain of distribution is more the service.
Correct, not the CE maker.
Yeah.
It's not even his clients that we're suing.
Right. So, in other words, the point is that
you're suing our members.
Who's your member?
Rex 7 Sirius.
Oh, I didn't know they were members.
I didn't know they were members. If I had known they were members, we never would have sued them.
There you go. Yeah, the wrath of CEA comes down upon
you. Let me take an early
you.
Friday. I'm here.
Oh dear. I actually want to follow up on what Chris just brought up, though, because, Michael, you brought up the Audio Home Recording Act several times, and I think it would be helpful to get more clarification on where exactly this fits in the debate. And Mitch, if we could start with you.
This is one of the great red herrings of all time. Maybe that's why it wasn't mentioned in the lawsuit. The Audio Home Recording Act, which was passed in 1992, which addressed consumer electronics manufacturers making off-the-shelf products that would lead to consumers engaging in serial copying that would lose, there would be no degradation of quality in serial copying. So you had a digital audio tape. Remember those? They never really took off. There was a big fear that consumers would have a tape-to-tape deck. So just by my terminology here, I think you're sort of understanding the difference between what this law was aimed at and what's happening now. You would have a tape-to-tape deck where a consumer would be able to put a quote-unquote master purchase digital audio tape in one side And then they would be able to put a blank tape in another side, and they'd be able to keep making tapes, and there'd be no degradation of quality, and they'd be able to give them out to the rest of the world. And so the idea of the Audio Home Recording Act, a very silly act, which I wasn't around at the time. I'm sure Jay Berman loved it. I don't think it's so great, but anyway, it went into law. It basically said that if a deal is struck where technology is incorporated into the device that will prevent serial copying, the copying of a copy, then, and in addition, if a small capped revenue was paid on both the device and the media, in other words, a tax put onto the device and the blank media, then the consumer electronics manufacturer who made the off-the-shelf device that the consumer is using to engage in this serial copying will not be able to be sued for contributorily for contributing to the infringement of the consumer. Okay, so that was that scenario and what that law applies to. Okay, now we have a service. We have a service like XM. It's not that we're suing Samsung. We're not suing Pioneer for making an off-the-shelf recorder that a consumer's using. You have a service like XM that has a direct connection with the consumer. So the broadcaster is now in control of what the consumer receives in a direct connection. And the broadcaster is saying, if you will come to me and pay me X amount per month, I will give you a service that allows you to keep the songs that are broadcast off the radio in a manner that is very much like a subscription service. I will alert you when a song is being played so that you can manually record it whenever you want. And I will give you this.
Sorry, it doesn't mention, doesn't do that.
I have the device. I've been alerted.
Wait, it does not do that.
It does do that.
It doesn't do that.
It does do that.
I think we have a question for that. Wait, maybe Mitch has a more advanced version.
Maybe there's a difference between the service and the device. Does the service do that, right?
If you want to know when something is playing on a particular station, you will get a little alert, and it will tell you what channel to go to.
But it doesn't automatically record it.
I just said the word manual.
That's fine.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So anyway, you were just trying to throw me off track. I was like, I was in the groove. Michael, where was I?
You're doing fine.
But. Thank you. No, at any rate, the point is that the Audio Home Recording Act, written in 1992, didn't conceive of this, isn't aimed at this, doesn't apply to these types of services. And that is why it is not the subject of the lawsuit. It's not the subject of legislation right now. It is the grand red herring du jour that Michael will now obsess about.
Let me respond to that. As you can imagine, Mitch has a somewhat narrower interpretation of what the Audio Home Recording Act covered than I do. Fortunately, mine is in accord with Congress. Let me read you from the House report. Also, the reported legislation will cover all digital audio recording technology that now exists or is developed in the future.
That
sounds
pretty
broad.
Wait.
I'm not done. The Audio Home Recording Act of 1992 is designed to put an end to these debates, were it were so, and facilitate the wide-scale introduction of digital audio recording technology to the American consumer. Now, you may look back and you may say that's silly, but I think it's pretty plain what was intended here and what Congress thought it was doing.
Let me jump in here, if I could, Michael, because I'd like to bring Chris in on that. You've observed the marketplace since this act was passed. How effective do you think it's been? What's your reaction to the way it's turned out?
Well, I also did a little bit of work on the Rio case, which is the only story on the other side. So I've been on both sides of this. One thing about the Audio Home Recording Act, I believe there's an audit provision in the Audio Home Recording Act, isn't there? Right? Has anybody ever audited under the Audio Home Recording Act?
Good question. I don't know.
So I guess we'll just take you at your word that everybody's paying what they're supposed to pay for all the devices they're supposed to pay it on and all the media they're supposed to pay it on too, right? But I guess someone could audit.
Do you have any reason to believe they're not?
I think what he's alluding to is if you go into Best Buy, you know, you can buy a big giant spindle of a million blank CDs, and of course you can recuse them to record music, and there's no tax paid on them. But if you pay $2.99 in a nice pretty jewel box that says music on it for the same exact CD, then you pay the tax. And I think what you might be alluding to is the fact that they only pay on things that are purposely packaged and more expensive when the exact same product is offered without the advertisement. You can buy it for nothing and no tax.
Yeah, I don't think anybody denies that these products are covered under the HRA and royalties are being paid.
All right. Well, let's move on from there. We've been talking about this whole issue about the distribution versus performance license, but I'd like to get back to something I mentioned in the beginning about the fair market value provision of licensing. And I've watched the CARP proceedings over the years. I know we have this new copyright royalty board or something. I'm sure they're going to be miraculously better than the CARPs were. I have every confidence of that. But I can't figure out exactly what fair market value is. I know what it is in a market. I don't know what it is in a licensing regime. So I was hoping to get some enlightenment on that. Mitch?
Well, if you ever become enlightened, please share it with me. It is, the problem with a compulsory license is it's a government license. It's not the marketplace. It's never going to give you the money that you would get in the marketplace because it's the government. It's not the marketplace. And so all it can do is try and mimic the marketplace as much as possible by guessing and looking at some evidence that might be available in the marketplace that it can then adapt and perhaps adopt. And so all we can try and do for a rate standard in these government proceedings is force them to the extent possible to mimic the marketplace as much as possible, knowing, and they know it, that they're never really going to replicate the marketplace. And so the idea here is to put a fair market value standard in, which is a standard used in other compulsory licenses, and it's a standard used in the arbitration code of the United States, and it's a standard used in the United States code about 500 times in lots of different scenarios, so there's not a mystery here. But to try to make sure that the value of the music ascribed by a board of three people for an entire industry tries as hard as it can to mimic what you would otherwise get in the marketplace. And, you know, the standard that exists right now for some services but not others, there's a disparity here too, which is why parity is important. If you're a webcaster, the standard is what would a willing buyer pay a willing seller in the marketplace? It is sort of a microscopic definition of fair market value. But the satellite guys pay under what's called the 801B standard, which is sort of fair and equitable and taking into account a bunch of factors. And the only decision that's ever been released under that standard for this particular purpose, the arbitrators stated in the opinion itself that this was a below market value price. And so what we're trying to do is, again, take a step toward equity and make sure that they are forced to at least consider a standard for everyone that's fair to each party, where everybody pays under the same rate, and that mimics the marketplace as much as it can be mimicked in a government licensing law.
That all sounds quite reasonable, fair market value, except in this situation there's no market. You've got five or four major record labels. But it's there's not a free market, it's an oligopoly. And that's why, you know, the reasonable return standard makes sense. Previously, when we tried to use the fair market value standard in the Shavia context, Congress had to come in and reduce the rate by about 40%. You can't say fair market value when there's no market.
Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't have a government license which says that the companies can't go out into the marketplace and negotiate separately and fairly, and then by imposing a government license say, well, there's no market, so now they're using their power to get an unfair price. I mean, either don't have the government license and allow the marketplace to work, or have a license and for convenience purposes allow the industries on both sides to negotiate collectively because there's no danger of antitrust violations, because at the end of the day there's a government rate that's going to be the be-all and end-all, not a market rate, and do it a convenient way that allows your companies to deposit one check with the government instead of paying us in the market. I mean, have either way that you like. We'd prefer the former rather than the latter. We'd prefer to repeal the license and to do this in the marketplace where there is none of this issue or problem. But if you're going to impose a government licensing structure to deplete a marketplace, don't then complain that there's no marketplace and it's all been depleted.
I'd like to bring Lee into the discussion if I could, because you have member companies that are under the willing buyer, willing seller that we just heard about. How do you feel about a shift to fair market value?
We're for going to a fair market value or an 801B type standard generally, because right now, we're involved in a CRB proceeding right now that uses the willing buyer and willing seller standard. And I mean, all of these things, you know, Mitch makes kind of a good point in that all of these things ultimately, you know, grind down to it being a battle of the economists essentially, because there is no marketplace that you can really directly point to, and so everybody kind of fabricates some analogy to what they think is the closest thing to the marketplace, and clearly the biases in how you establish those models come out. But I think the 801B standards and the idea of a real fair market value are more attractive to us than the current willing buyer, willing seller standard.
Okay.
It's got more fair factors involved.
All right. I'd like to move on. We've heard a lot of talk about terrestrial radio, about the broadcasters, and we know that they're under a local service area performance right exemption, and that's something that is very important to them to preserve, I would have to assume. And we have not talked yet here today much about the copy protection mechanisms that one would adopt under these licenses. But my understanding is that the broadcasters are concerned about having that apply to their digital services, which I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, would include the HD radio as well as their internet simulcasting. And but what I gather they're arguing is that if they could keep that performance right exemption and apply it to their internet simulcast within 150-mile radius, their local listening area, that they would actually be okay with reasonable technology protection mechanisms. So I'm curious, in particular, Mitch, but what people would think about a compromise like that.
Well, I don't think it's a fair trade when people aren't, when they're not paying us money for over-the-air now, and they're there's an inequity between, you know, the DEMA folks and the satellite folks who do pay and the terrestrial guys who don't, to increase that inequity by furthering their exemption. So what the only thing that they do have to pay for now, which is simulcasting their signal on the internet, they also wouldn't have to pay for. I think you're talking about apples and oranges. One is money and the other is content protection. And what they want to do is, you know, trade money for content protection and basically say, hey, if we don't have to pay you anything for over the air now, but if we don't have to pay you for simulcasts either, maybe we'll consider protecting your music. I mean, you know, come on. You should protect our music. This is helping you. We are providing the creations with all of our partners that you are making money off of, and you certainly care about signal protection. I mean, everybody believes in protecting their signal. If you're a satellite company, you encrypt your signal so no one can steal it. If you're a radio company, you would like to make sure that you have a signal protection that's recognized worldwide so no one steals the signal, because you need the Nielsen ratings on the advertisements to make your money. But stealing the music contained in the signal, somebody else's problem. If they pay me, maybe, you know, I'll protect their stuff too. I just don't think that that's a fair trade from a policy point of view. I think that if they are bifurcated, then let's deal with content protection, and we should deal with payment when we can.
Now, Mitch, when you say stealing, do you mean stealing or simply recording free over-the-air broadcast radio?
Well, I think if you're – when I was using the word stealing with regard to signal protection, and I think that any broadcaster or webcaster would tell you that if you take their signal in a way that they don't authorize, they would call that stealing.
I think a couple of points here. Number one, you know, clearly we regard – you know, recording free over-the-air broadcast radio as fair use is recognized by Congress, as consumers have been doing for decades, which is, you know, very different from mass indiscriminate redistribution over the internet, which we all agree is bad. I think the issue of performance rights and you know, what the obligation should be on broadcast radio is an interesting discussion. Again, satellite radio is paying tens of millions, and broadcasters are paying nothing. You got bizarre results, like you've got record labels who illegally pay radio stations to play songs, give them money. And meanwhile, the same record labels are demanding enormous sums from XM and Sirius for playing music. So the whole thing is a bit odd. You know, as far as content protection, once again, I think we all agree that preventing mass indiscriminate redistribution is okay. Unfortunately, many of the broadcast flag proposals that have been introduced go way beyond that and also impact consumers' non-commercial use at home, you know, for private purposes, and that's something that we think should be protected.
Lee, do you have some thoughts?
We just really think that the two issues shouldn't be joined. Obviously, with regard to the 150-mile exception, I would echo some of Mitch's comments. The big elephant in the room that isn't really discussed by the Act is the fact that terrestrial radio gets their broadcast rights of the recordings for free, and to extend that now to any type of internet or digital-based, broadcast, just because it happens to occur in 150-mile radius of the broadcast tower, seems to me that it just goes overreaching. With regard to trying to offset that by some type of content protection, we disagree with the idea that those two ideas should be intermingled at all. In terms of content protection, as far as we're concerned, it seems to us that content protection should really only apply to those types of services that are engendering the retention of the content and the further use of the content by the end user.
Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I think the idea is that you shouldn't be obligated to employ some type of some type of DRM that's set by somebody who doesn't have anything to do with your business. You shouldn't be forced either economically or technologically to adopt some procedure to protect content unless you are actively soliciting the further use of that content. In other words, if you're just broadcasting, if you're just sending the signal out, and you don't have a business model, you don't have a technology, you don't have a service or a device that asks that enables or entices the end user to retain the material that you've broadcast, you should really just be able to freely broadcast, and you shouldn't be strapped into some type of DRM system that has otherwise been established by someone. So that's the view regarding content protection.
Doesn't the webcast industry, by and large, use a certain kind of DRM?
There are certain types of DRM that are used depending on the technology that's used.
And they do that voluntarily, or is that a legal mandate?
I think it's mandated. If I remember correctly, it's mandated if you use the technology. If it's there, you have to enable it, I think, is the way it works.
But, is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Chris, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, we haven't really talked about stream ripping here, but I'm assuming that no matter what DRM you put on a webcast stream or any kind of streaming signal on the internet, there are programs out there called stream rippers that will allow you to create a MP3 or WAV file from that stream. I'm hoping I'm not giving anybody any illicit ideas here, but there are such devices, and there are other people who helpfully have created plugins for those devices that will ping the Gracenote database, for example, and conveniently load all these tracks into your iPod along with the associated metadata. Now, this is adding insult to injury. You know, if you're someone who makes a living from songwriting or being a recording artist or a musician. So when you talk about DRM for the webcast signal, that's fine. Except that it doesn't really go far enough because of these stream rippers, which actually are creating, adding to a fairly significant problem.
Does the Perform Act terms, I know it's not technology specific, it just kind of defines a general approach. Would it cover stream ripping, Mitch?
Nope.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Wait.
Yeah. There's
Mike,
a,
not, not a good reader.
Okay. But there's a provision of the Perform Act which says that if you are under the copyright license, you need to, if it is reasonably available in the marketplace, and it is technologically feasible, and it is economically reasonable, if all those things are true, then you need to employ anti-stream ripping technology to prevent the problem. Stream ripping technology to prevent the problem that Chris just illustrated.
Yeah, I guess our issue is that, you know, it's speaking to the larger issue of recording over the internet. The Perform Act doesn't apply to that, except for the TPMs you were talking about. The much larger issue of over-the-air broadcasters and what their obligations ought to be, which I think is, as you said, the elephant sitting on the kitchen table. Doesn't apply to that. You know, what the Perform Act does do, regardless of talk of equities, is single out one single service, which is unfortunately the only service that's already paying tens of millions of dollars to Mitch's members. And we find that to be, frankly, non-equitable.
We've heard a lot today about how we've had laws in the past that are clearly not capable of handling today's technology and today's market offerings. And I know it's good for IP lawyers if we have to keep coming back and doing this, and it keeps the Hill staff here busy. But what I would love to see is legislation that could address the current problems but would also be flexible enough to accommodate new technologies and new services as they come, so we don't have to keep coming back to this. So I'll go the other way, maybe start with Chris, and try to get some impressions here of to what extent you think Perform gets there or how we might get there.
Well, I think from depending on which side of the fence you're on, I would think from the label's point of view, from the artist's point of view, it goes a fair distance down the path on the digital transmission side of the house. It doesn't go far enough, as far as I'm concerned. None of the fact that terrestrial broadcast radio doesn't pay a performance royalty on the sound recordings to me is something which it's sort of like losing Poland. You know, I mean, it happened, you know, and it's been a constant fight ever since to get it back. You know, so I think eventually we're going to get there, and this is another step down.
We're going to liberate Poland someday.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But you know, there are some issues that weren't addressed, like interactivity, for example. There's some folk that would like to have a broader definition of non-interactive, because the payments for non-interactive go through Sound Exchange, and what that means, this is one of those inside baseball things where a page of history is worth a volume of logic. The reason why people want it to go through Sound Exchange is because it's not, those monies are not applied against, or not paid under the artist's contract, and therefore are not applied against unrecouped balances. And when you look at the fact that, to say something positive about XM and webcasters, is that there's a lot of catalog that's getting played that hadn't been played in a very long time. And so, you know, these catalog artists very often are unrecouped. And, you know, under the terms of the contract that we're negotiating, so there's no shenanigans, particularly aside from the general shenanigans, you know, that go on in negotiating record deals. So if those artists have that money from digital radio, let's say digital transmissions, paid to them under their artist agreements, and it's applied against unrecouped balance, it's like it didn't happen, right? Because they don't get any benefit from it. And these are people very often whose records have been deleted from the current catalog of the record company, and they can't get the record company to let them put their own records out. So it really is kind of insult to injury. However, you know, looking at it from the record company's perspective, if you say that all digital transmissions in a world where we're moving towards a significant number or a significant amount of revenue coming from digital transmissions are paid off contract, you know, if I'm a record company, I'm going to say that's fine. I'm going to reduce the advances I'm paying you, and I'm going to adjust the economics of the record deal accordingly. So That's another tension that was not addressed, I think, to the satisfaction of some people in the current draft of the bill.
Okay. Lee?
Yeah, I don't know how much I can go off the script, and I think I've been doing a pretty bad job of stuttering my way through the script anyway. With regard to the idea of bringing broadcast radio into it and the idea that perhaps the act doesn't go far enough because it really kind of leaves that outside the room that the act addresses, yeah, I mean, the point was made earlier that, you know, how can it be equity if everybody, you know, how can it be parity if everybody, truly everybody who's involved with the business isn't, you know, at the same level, and I think that's true. Ideally, we'd love to see complete parity amongst all types of formats, all types of technology, all types of media. Given that that's probably not going to happen now, and I appreciate Chris saying that we may be inching our way towards it, and it may not happen this year or next, but it'll happen sometime, largely we'll take what we can get right now. Mm-hmm. And to have a little bit of parity amongst the people that engage in some of the largely analogous, no pun intended, between analog and digital businesses that my company's engaged in, we'll take it. You know, we'd rather get a little bit better, a little bit closer to a full level playing field, and we'll bite off each bit as we can.
All right, Michael.
Certainly, I think as technology moves forward, every now and then it's important to look at the overall royalty structure and you know, look at it in a comprehensive way to make sure that everybody's being adequately compensated, as opposed to singling out specific technologies and specific services. That being said, I would like to take issue with any implication the Audio Home Recording Act is outmoded or doesn't apply. What's interesting is that every element of this device has been on the marketplace for a long time. Handheld digital recorders were available in the 1990s, devices that could record digital transmissions, the ability to make playlists, they've all been around for a long time. And what this device does is take all those functions and puts them together and just makes it easier. But it doesn't, strictly speaking, do anything new. So just because these products realize all the aspects that were addressed in the Audio Home Recording Act doesn't mean the Audio Home Recording Act is out of date. You know, to the contrary, the fact that these new devices comply with the Audio Home Recording Act should be viewed as evidence that Congress anticipated a legislative solution for digital radio, and the Audio Home Recording Act actually works.
Mitch.
Okay. All you have to do, after listening to all this legal mucky-muck, is look on the Circuit City website at what the consumers say about the S50 device. Wow, this is really cool. I'll never buy music again. Are you substituting for a sale or aren't you? What's the right policy decision? If you are substituting for a sale, you're not performing, you're not just listening off the radio. If you're substituting for a sale, should you have an obligation to compensate for the loss of the sale to the creators of the product? That's the policy question. It really is that simple. You have all the evidence you need by anybody who's ever played with the device and said, this is the greatest thing in the world now, I don't have to buy my music. And the answer is, it's not the whole banana. It's half the banana, but it's really important, and it's a necessary step, and we need to do it sooner rather than later before the inequities get so out of whack that it actually takes the same type of toll that P2P piracy did, where artist rosters are slashed by yet another third, and the other half of Music Row in Nashville goes up for rent, and you enter a crisis where there's no product to put on these fantastic devices so that consumers can't get the diversity that they need. We are interconnected. We make it. They sell it. They don't want to pay for it. We want them to pay for it. And it's a question of fairness. And we have to move one step closer to that before he foams at the mouth. One step closer to that end goal, and perform is a necessary step.
I sound like a broken record, but we're paying. Can you stipulate that we're paying? Wait. Let me finish.
Am I in a deposition?
Wait. First of all,
you're paying for the performance. There is a difference in the copyright.
And we're paying royalties on the device, as the law says. Second of all, as far as the lost sale, you know what the numbers say? We have data that shows that XM and Sirius subscribers, they tend to be music people. They buy more CDs. They buy more music. They go to more concerts. They discover bands on XM and Sirius because they have large playlists, and they tell their friends about them. So it's I mean, that's what, you know, our numbers show that those subscribers are your best customers. And, you know, to the extent you're saying that what these are causing are sales displacements and lost sales by the music industry, I'd love to see a survey. I'd love to see some facts. I'd love to see some kind of proof before we run around imposing government technology mandates on these new products. I think that's the least you can do.
Well, first of all,
there
are no tech mandates, which is why it will accommodate the future, which I think is a good step. The second thing is that you have to let people who have exclusive rights run their own businesses and make their own mistakes. If we're wrong and you're great for us and we're just too stupid to recognize that, that's our decision to make. But the other thing is, you know, I have a terrific idea. We know that technology buyers usually go out and buy even more technology. So we ought to have a mandated government licensing system that says that the government will set the price for every consumer electronics device that comes out, and we will only allow people to pay what's fair and equitable according to what the government thinks for that particular device. And don't worry, because consumers love them so much that they're going to go out and buy even more, because it's really great for your business and you just don't know it. I mean, it's so ridiculous to sit there and say to creators of products in business that they just don't know what the hell's good for them, and to protect their rights, they're just idiots. It's just, it's sort of insulting. And
no,
I don't know why I'm so worked up today.
I'm not saying you don't know what's good. No, I think you know exactly what's good for you, and your business is an oligopoly, and you're trying to extract maximum rent.
I understand this oligopoly thing. You know, you hear this a lot, just because there's, you know, four and maybe soon to be three major labels. You know, there's a lot of other people out there. And I realize that if your only contact with the recording industry is in this city, and you don't ever go to a nightclub, and you don't ever go, you know, anywhere where music is being played, you may not be aware of the fact that there's probably, you know, 60,000 releases. I don't know what the number is. It's close to that, though, every year, by people that have nothing to do with any of these labels, right? And there's a lot of people out there who are affected by what happens and who have as much a right to step up to the table and be heard about this stuff as the majors do. And you know, in a sense, if you look at all the members of the RAAA, as well as A2IM and, you know, some of the other organizations that are starting to weigh in on this stuff, there's a lot of people out there that have nothing to do with the major labels. And honestly, the major labels are increasingly only dealing with the hit product that because major labels are increasingly doing an increasingly worse job of developing the artists in the early stages up to 100. I mean, you can't get to a million if you don't get to 100,000, okay? So the fact of the matter is that the people that you're serving, you know, are predominantly on XM, and I'm an XM subscriber. I love XM. I think Lee Abrams should be the chairman of the FCC, and that would be a trip, you know, if that were to happen. But it would shake things up in a positive way, I think. But, you know, the people that you're talking to about, or you're talking about in terms of who you're servicing, are mostly not artists who are on major labels. They're if you listen to a lot of the real promotional value that you're giving, if you listen to the stations that provide real promotional value, true promotional value, where you're truly introducing people to new music, you've got three or four channels on XM that do that. The rest of it is all hit-driven radio, all hit-driven artists that major record companies and artists and managers and publishers and a lot of other people have spent a lot of time developing and grooming in spite of terrestrial broadcast radio, if you ask me. Who, you know, would be happy if they never had to add another record ever, right? Because they're worried about burn. And these are the people whose investment you're free riding on. So I mean, what I would say to you is that if you wanna have us invest in your business, then let us benefit from the reward. So what I would suggest to you in a good old Silicon Valley fashion, okay, is put some stock in escrow. Have every one of your members put like a million shares of stock in escrow. And your members too, for that matter.
How dare
you? You know, we'll see. And if you're up in 2 years and, you know, from the benefit of using our product, then that's great. Then we'll just take all that stock and we'll distribute it out to,
to artists and publishers and songwriters.
That's and you know something, given the onslaught of harmful legislation and lawsuits, I'm sure the stock is going to do great. It's a terrific idea. You know, first of all, you know, certainly there are a lot of independent artists out there. Independent artists are the ones who benefit most from XM and Sirius because they're the same ones that can't break into the narrow playlists of commercial radio. You know, but the fact is that the major labels do represent the lion's share of the music industry. It's just the fact. And if you're going to be in this business, that's who you've got to deal with. And they, you know, really do, just in an economic sense, have a lock on the industry. Not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's simply the reality that licensees like XM and Sirius deal under.
Are XM and Sirius a duopoly then?
All right. Moderator's prerogative here. I'm going to jump in. And by the way, I hope all your reporters out there heard that the RIA now is backing like a compulsory license for consumer electronics products. So make sure you lead your stories with that. I'm going to ask one more question, then we're going to open it up to the audience. And my question is just specifically for Michael, and it's probably going to cost me that VIP pass at the Consumer Electronics Show. It's a two-part question. First part is Sirius a member of CEA?
Yes.
Okay. Was Sirius wrong to privately negotiate license with the record labels for their devices?
I can't comment on Sirius's business deals. That would be totally inappropriate.
Okay, well, we just put that out there, that there are two different approaches taken by the duopoly.
Let me elaborate on that a little bit. You know, getting beyond the present situation, we're in a situation now, generally speaking, where if you bring out a new product, and this is in the audio space and the video space and whatever, that allows consumers to use media in a new and flexible way, you're probably going to get sued or be threatened with being sued. You know, if you're a big company, if you're Apple, if you're Intel, whatever, it's in the legal budget and you just deal with it. If you're a smaller company, if you're a new company, if you're a startup, that's a big deal, and it's potentially a deal breaker for you. We have a company called SEMA Video Technologies that was recently sued by the Motion Picture Association. You've got companies, again, very small startup companies like Sling, you know, where you hear kind of rumors of lawsuits because the content industry is trying to leverage them and to putting out certain features or not including certain features. You know, so especially as a new startup tech company involved in the media space, you know, the threat of lawsuits these days, unfortunately, is something you got to deal with. And I think all these companies, you know, make their individual decisions about how they want to play that and what they need to do. You know, I mean, certainly, even if you think you're going to be vindicated in court, there's a question of you know, do you want to take on tens of millions of dollars in legal fees. That's a tough issue.
Or get a license. That's another option.
Or not include certain features or whatever. I mean, there are plenty of options out there, and different companies do different things. The one thing I can tell you is that this is not a particularly good thing for innovation. This is not a particularly good thing for venture capitalists. And the last thing, if you're a venture capitalist, you want to do is invest in a lawsuit for obvious reasons. And you know, in a time when we're worried about, you know, how are we going to innovate? How are we going to compete with India and China? These companies these countries that are building their entire tech industry to compete with us. You know, for the innovation industry, that's not a healthy climate.
All right, I did want to open it up to all of you for questions. If you'd wait for Marie to bring a microphone to you, and when you have the microphone, if you would identify yourself and where you're with, so we can have that. And why don't I see a show of hands for questions here? Oh, Sarah in the back there.
Hi, Sarah Sterland with National Journal's Technology Daily. Mitch, I just had a quick question about the XM lawsuit. One of the claims in the lawsuit is that XM's a contributory infringer. I mean, that they're helping customers infringe. But if the customers have already paid and they know that the music is going to expire if they let their subscriptions expire, how can the court find them to have infringed? I mean, they're not the ones licensing the music. They're just, you know, buying a subscription.
Right. That's what's so interesting is that the consumers are paying XM. They're not paying the creators. No money is going to the creators for their attention of the copy. And so part of the problem here, the lawsuit goes down in different stages too. It first and most importantly alleges direct infringement. And I want to be very clear about that. The allegation is that XM is a direct infringer, that they are offering the service, that they are operating like a subscription service would, that their service includes the retention of a copy, and that they are not compensating for that. And my guess is you're reading down claims and then getting down to, you know, if not direct, then contributory. And the truth of the matter is that if something is being, if a copy is being made without permission and without compensation, then there's infringement. And that's the grand ruse that's being played on consumers here. They think that what they're doing is fine because XM is providing it for them and they're paying a subscription fee. You know, this is exactly what happened in the P2P context when Kazaa came out with a service that consumers paid $9.95 for or $29.95 for. And a lot of consumers said, well, what's the problem? I'm paying for it. You know, there is an obligation for somebody providing a service to make sure that when they are providing consumers with the ability to do something, that that something be legal.
I would suggest that maybe those consumers aren't silly or negligent. Maybe those consumers read the law, specifically Title 17 of the U.S. Code. Again, the Audio Home Recording Act, which says no action may be brought under this title based on the non-commercial use by a consumer of such a device or medium for making digital musical recordings or analog musical recordings. So maybe those consumers were silly and thought they were okay.
All right. Any more questions? Oh, here we go. David.
Thanks. David Carson, Copyright Office. Let's assume for the moment that this device, the XM device, is lawful under the Audio Home Recording Act. Michael has said, in that case, we're compensating the performers and the copyright owners by paying the Audio Home Recording Act royalties. Just wondering, for each song that an end user reproduces on that device, how much in royalties is the copyright owner and is the performer getting? And let's compare that, for example, to the royalties they might be getting from a download on iTunes.
Thank you, Congressman Murphy. Let me address that. No, that's not the Congress. First of all, consumers aren't required to pay on a per recording basis because that's fair use. However, Congress, in its wisdom, set up a system, and that system is the Audio Home Recording Act. And since with XM, like the radio station can't tell what you're recording, they can't tell how often you're recording, they're not controlling the process. And Congress knew that happened with digital transmissions. So what Congress said was, we'll have a royalty of up to $8 per device, and that will be distributed to the recording industry, to performers, for songwriters, and that's where they get compensated. So that's the structure that Congress set up.
Okay, so here's your answer. the total annual revenues that come in from the Audio Home Recording Act are about $2 million for the year. That's split between the record labels, the music publishers, the songwriters, the recording artists, the unions. Okay? I think the number of downloads per day is almost 2 million.
On these?
Downloads in the country, and that's not even including the licenses on subscription agreements, which are like those. So the revenue per year that is paid under the Audio Home Recording Act, which obviously was not meant to compensate for this type of activity, is about what would be made per day just in the download business, not even including subscriptions.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. This is the first mass marketed product that's going to be, you know, under the Audio Home Recording Act. These products have been on the market for a couple of months. So at present, you know, the royalties are minimal because the products have just gotten there. But we anticipate, you know, if these are successful products, which we certainly hope they will be, the royalties are going to be significant.
I think it's
capped. But again, it's based on what consumers do.
It's capped. It's capped under the statute. You can't go up.
Okay, it's capped. Dan.
Can I ask you a stupid question? You're saying all this about...
Identify yourself, please.
Sorry, Dan Horowitz of the Small Business Committee. You're talking about XM and Sirius having to pay additional royalties? Is that what you're trying to say? Mitch? Is he saying XM and Sirius?
No, actually, it's not XM and Sirius. It's, I think, Pioneer and Samsung who are paying what Michael is talking about are AHRA royalties, Audio Home Recording Act royalties, and not XM and Sirius, but I believe they shuffled the tiny amount of money off on the commissioned consumer electronics guys who made the design that they commanded, and they pay under the Audio Home Recording Act. And the question was, well, isn't that enough compensation so that we don't have to worry about going and getting licenses in the marketplace? And my answer is absolutely not. A capped royalty from the two CE manufacturers is...
That being said, under to draw a parallel, do you have that same parallel with Muzak and their equipment manufacturers?
You mean, do the equipment manufacturers for Muzak pay under the Audio Home Recording Act?
Correct. Because, I mean, isn't that a satellite system of sorts?
Does Muzak have a specific exemption, though?
Yeah, they're not enabling recording, right?
Yeah. We're just
talking about... And they have their own
rate
structure.
I think Muzak is just a listening service, and that listening service is covered as a pre-existing service under the license, and there was a special provision for them that was put in.
Okay, so there's a carve-out for them.
Wasn't really a carve-out.
It's not a recording device.
Yeah, it's not a carve-out for them as supplying a recording device. It's a carve-out for them as a music service.
As a music service for listening.
They pay a percentage of gross revenues, is that right? Or something like that? They have their own rate structure, don't they?
I can't remember.
Yeah. They're one of the pre-existing services.
Wait, he's trying to trip me up?
No.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay, great. I want to thank everyone for coming. I want to thank, in particular, Eileen Golding for booking the room, and Marie Ryan for doing logistics, and Amy Smroden for letting everybody know about the event. And, of course, I want to thank our four panelists, including George and Gracie down at the end. I don't know if they heard that. They're going to go all night, I think. All right, thank you, everyone.